So I'm right here at the Retrospective Facilitators Gathering, and I'm super honored to have a conversation with Diana Larsen today, which has inspired me as an Agilist for many years, and I've followed a lot of material which actually Diana did release over the years, and also had some great sessions over various conferences. So I'm super honored that you take the time and have that conversation with me today, when we're going to dive deep into the topic of learning and insights and knowledge. So thanks for joining our podcast, Diana.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here.
Yes. Yeah. And so right now we're in a really inspiring atmosphere here in Austria at the Retrospective Facilitators Gathering, which has been happening for a long time. This is the 21st edition right here. And I think you've been at probably a lot of them, right?
All but two,
yes. Yeah. And I was surprised that I've joined 5 so far, which also surprised me that there have been that many from my perspective. And the first one has been 12 years ago, so I kind of joined midway when it was existing. And okay. I still remember one session, and I think you facilitated that one where we had a timeline created of the RFGs like those 12 years ago. And that one has been particularly been interesting to learn a bit about why this conference exists and what this tribe is about. And okay. maybe for the listeners who are not so familiar with this small, very small tribe here, could you elaborate a little bit about how did it come to life? What was it about that this gathering even is happening?
Well, sure, yes. And I guess you've already had or will be posting a conversation you've had with Norm Kurth.
Yes, definitely.
And it definitely started with Norm. Mm. He had written a book called Project Retrospectives. And we were thinking about how do we help people learn to facilitate in this way? And because our focus originally was primarily on people who were already doing meeting facilitation and so on. And he started hearing from people around who had read the articles that he published before the book and then the book. And we thought, oh, wouldn't it be cool to bring these people together? And so he also enlisted Esther Derby. And so the three of us hosted the first Retrospective Facilitator Gathering in Newport, Oregon in 2002. And then it was successful, and people came from Europe even to attend it. And there was a hotel that we held the event in, and it had 20 rooms, and we filled all the 20 rooms, and we thought, well, let's do that again. So we did it again in 2003, and along the way, one of the people who had come from Europe said, well, how about if we have some of these in Europe and not just in the U.S.? And so we agreed to do that. And so then there was one also in Austria, in Baden. And it just kept going. Then it just kept going like that every other year until the pandemic, at which point we had a pause of a couple of years. And which is why, you know, from 2002 to 2025 is 23 years, but this is the 21st Retrospective Gathering. So, but we picked right up where we had left off when it became, started feeling like it was safe to do so. And it's just been going ever since. And new people come, some of the same people come, and then new people come, and other folks feel like they've gotten what they need from it and they stop coming. But we always seem to be able to get enough people, and both a large enough group and a small enough group. Mm. For it to be, you know, a rich learning community that yeah. comes together to talk about all things associated with retrospectives.
Yeah. Yeah. You already used the word learning community.
Yes.
And if you have ever facilitated an Agile retrospective as a Scrum Master, as you're listening to our podcast, then you might wonder, why the heck do people meet for 5 days in an open space format if it's about retrospectives? Right. And what I've sensed is that a lot of sessions are also dealing with stuff which is somehow connected to learning and to what the world is going through and this AI transformation and a lot of sessions on that one also. So it is somehow connected to retrospectives as a learning ritual, but it's more than that, right?
Right. Well, once we started associating, I mean, Norm's book was about big retrospective, 3-day retrospectives at the end of a very long project that had included a lot of people, mostly individual contributors, and getting them to come together. But after a couple of years, I mean, the Agile Manifesto was published in 2001, so it came in just only a year before we started, and very soon we began to talk about, well, why would we wait to the very end of a deliverable? Why wouldn't we, since we're working in iterations or sprints, and that seems to be the pattern, why wouldn't we do this at the end of every iteration or at the end of every sprint? And that's why then Esther and I were encouraged to write our book, the Agile Retrospectives book. And so that also really blew things up. But, you know, in that book, Esther and I proposed a framework because we knew that now we were moving into a world where it wasn't just people who were experienced facilitators.
Yeah.
It was going to be team leads, tech leads, Scrum masters. Once Scrum really adopted the idea of it, and so we knew that those folks didn't necessarily have skills at facilitating meetings, so we wanted to make sure that we included some things for them.
And that was so true. When I started with Scrum, I was a .NET software developer and basically studying computer science and came to using Scrum because I needed something to organize my team, and I found some slide decks of my own which were free to use and stuff, and introduced Scrum to my team. And from that day on, I was not only a developer in the team, but also the Scrum Master. And to be honest, I had no clue about facilitation. So that book really came in really handy, basically, for me to have something. Oh, there's a check-in moment and there's a closing and setting the stage and all this. It just helped me to get in the mood of what am I supposed to do here, right?
Right.
Yeah. And of course, the first retrospectives, they sucked. I mean, like, how skillful are you with something new? And which so far I had no community, no connect to any facilitators, but just me as a computer scientist trying to do the best for my team, right?
Okay.
And so it was super helpful to have a framework basically I could play with and some guidance in having that, because I had nobody around who had that knowledge back then.
And we included the set the stage phase and the close the retrospectives phase specifically because we knew people weren't necessarily going to know how to get a meeting started well and how to end it well. I mean, we've all been in meetings that just kind of kept going of their own accord and nobody seemed to know how to stop. And so we wanted to be very clear with people. There's a beginning and there's an end. And then in the middle, we do these much richer things that are gather data, set the state, or gather data, generate insights, and decide what to do. And it's shorthand mode. Esther and I started talking about learning.
Yeah.
Learning together, the team members learning together about what happened, thinking together, doing the analysis and about the implications of what happened, and then deciding together. Yeah. And making an action plan. And so learning became very central to the whole thing. We said, this is a meeting where we learn together, think together, and decide together. Mm-hmm. And all three of those activities are important.
Yeah.
And So learning, thinking, and deciding are all retrospective adjacent. So at the retrospective facilitators gathering, we end up with sessions about those different aspects, as well as other ones that are related to this work.
Yeah, and I love the circle you drew at some flip chart back then, which was like this, what, so what, now what, which is basically the core cycle of generating insights and making a clue of a situation. I think that's what also is happening here a lot, like what is happening in the world, what does it mean to us, and what are we going to do about that now?
Right.
Yeah, so the learning circle. And as we want to speak about learning, I've got the feeling that in larger organizations which are more used to agile, retrospectives have become some kind of a learning framework for the whole organization in a way that it generates insights which are important and which are spread throughout the organization. So maybe what's your perspective on the retrospectives and learning as a learning organization maybe?
Yeah, well, over the years, we've received a lot of feedback on what was in the book, what wasn't in the book, mm-hmm. And so on. And so we just last year published a second edition in which we added a lot of those kinds of things. But the in terms of organizations, I wish there were more organizations that actually embrace the idea of retrospectives all throughout, mm-hmm. because it's very powerful. I often will get comments about, well, we do retrospectives, but isn't it just a time for teams to vent? You know, they mm-hmm. just get things. Yeah. It's just, you know, and it's like, it's important maybe for teams to have times to vent. I mean, when things get frustrated, you know, you need to be able to let those emotions out. It's an emblematic of psychological safety that you can talk about things. But that's not really what a retrospective is for. A retrospective is to help us improve along all the dimensions of our work. And since I think more and more our work is learning work, we used to be called knowledge workers in our field and a lot of other creative fields. We'd be called knowledge workers. You work with the existing knowledge and manipulate it and do it into like accountants do. Mm-hmm. Who do valuable work, but they work from a system of thinking about numbers and credits and debits that has been around for a very long time. Software isn't like that. And a lot of the creative world isn't like that. New technologies, even the pieces of code that we built yesterday change what we are building on today, right? There's just this constant need to learning about our customers, learning about the devices that our software goes into, all those aspects. Learning has become so much more important to the work. It's not a nice thing we do for professional development. Actually, the skill of how do we learn has become critical. And do we know how to learn? Do we know how to think critically about things and then learn from what we've discovered? We talk about discovery being an important part of our work now. Mm-hmm. Discovery is learning work, right? Yeah. What's out there that's new that we need to know about? So as you can tell, this is a thing I am very passionate about. And making that shift to embracing the idea that we need to be learning all the time, and we need to give ourselves breaks as well. But the major part of our work is learning, then thinking about what we've learned and choosing whether or not that's going to change what we do next, mm-hmm. right? Which sounds a lot like a retrospective.
Yeah, definitely. And what I found personally is that that's a huge difference between knowledge and insights. So I can know things, but at some point of time, when something happens, maybe on a more emotional level, it sinks in and it becomes some kind of reality or truth inside of me, which guides my actions. And I can know things for years without feeling them and without them being any kind of wisdom inside. And there's an African saying which basically says, knowledge is only rumors till it lives in your bones. I love that sentence.
Yeah, that is lovely. Yeah.
And I think retrospectives are also a place where you can hear about knowledge, but as a collective process can generate a deeper insight, which then becomes relevant and has more feeling of being important to you and thus guide your actions.
Right. Right. Well, and I mean, the other thing that we're becoming aware of is how important unlearning is. I mean, what Barry O'Reilly wrote a whole book about unlearning, right? And that recognizing when the knowledge that we have that we maybe have been relying on or the assumptions that we've been using as we move forward, when those are no longer serving us, how do we move from that reliance or that assumption to figuring out what's working well about that and what do we need to do differently about that, and with regard to how we move forward. And so, yeah, the importance of learning, unlearning, relearning, coming back again. It fascinates me sometimes the ways in which we see new books published all the time that are talking about things that somebody published a book about 25 years ago or 40 years ago or 50 years ago, and saying many of the same things, but maybe with some new nuances, some more relevant anecdotes that are more like what work is now. You know, there's just different things, but it's like every generation of people needs to learn these same lessons, and they need to learn it in a way that makes sense in their context. Mm. And so a lot of what we need to learn, we just haven't put it in our bones. I love that. That's beautiful. We haven't put it in our bones in a way that allows us to apply it to our context.
Yeah. And I think this also spotlights the way of social learning. Mm-hmm. And I was surprised when I had a look at Takeuchi's and Nonaka's work, which has already influenced the new product development game, this whole Scrum game. I also found a paper about learning, which they published. It's a Seki model, which basically speaks about something you have as an individual target knowledge inside of yourself, and then you basically make it to explicit knowledge, and then it kind of comes out and gets in the scope of a group, and then gets then into new context, and then becomes integrated and internalized again, so that you basically influence. Maybe I've got three kids, right? So mm-hmm. I give a lot of those information in a way to my children, in the way what I accept and what I don't accept, and they have new target knowledge which they can then externalize and bring in the group context and add those new nuances, right? Mm-hmm. Which you just spoke about, this kind of and often these are not new things per se, but they are in the context of a new light and in new movement in the world, and then they make total sense for that moment in time, right?
Right, absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, the Toyota production system and the new product game and all of those also gave rise to Lean, which has the improvement kata, which talks about Kaizen and Kaikaku, different ways of learning. Are we learning incrementally? Which, if we're holding retrospectives every iteration, that is an opportunity for Kaizen. Or are we learning in Kaikaku, which is, oh my gosh, things are so much different than we thought they were going to be. We need to rethink this entirely, right? And have a new world, and which is why, you know, the idea of agile transformations became trendy. But the thing is, in the Western world, we associate transformation with something that has a beginning and an end. And the thing is, when you're living in a learning world like we are, there's no end.
Yeah.
There's only more to learn. There's only more to reevaluate, consider, is this still serving us, and so on. And that's why the skill of having someone on your team or someone available or to help a group of people learn, think, and decide together becomes so critically important, because we don't always, many of us do not learn those skills in school or from our families, or we might learn them if we're on a sports team or something and people stop to reevaluate how that last game went and watch the video of it and say, oh, well, you did this and I did that, and how did that work, and do we want to do that again? One of the things I love about Norm's book is one of the questions that he asks in a project retrospective is, you know, how did this effort go, this period of time you spent working together on this thing, right, whatever it is, right? And so often people say, oh, it was fine. And his question is, if you were to do it over again, would you do it in exactly the same way and be happy with the same results? And that's a whole other...
That's another question.
That's a whole other question. It's not just, are you satisfied? You know, can we move on now? You know, no. let's take a moment and learn from our experience. I mean, that's really the only way people learn, is by examining their experience. And they've been doing that for forever. We've been doing that forever, humans. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think it's also what separates us from other creatures on the planet, basically, that we have a capability to have this learning rituals instilled benefit from that. And often the insights from yesterday are the new questions for tomorrow, right? Because then we have this kind of insight and as a stepping stone to, okay, and if this is true for us here, what does this then mean for the future? And that's a process which is so individual per team, per organization, that it also lives and breathes in a way and cannot be replaced, right?
Absolutely, yeah. And I like what you just said because of its link to curiosity and questions. Mm. You know, where we get curious is where we ask questions. And the direction of questions that we ask is where we learn.
Yeah.
That process does that. And so for many of my teachers in the past have emphasized the importance of being willing to sit with a question, to be in inquiry, just kind of in that mode of what's going on here and what can I learn from it? And my son, Willem, is a tracker. He goes out in nature and, you know, different things and he tracks. And he talks about his teacher taught him to be able to sit in one spot in out in the world and find 50 questions to ask about that spot. Or about that rock or that tree or whatever. And that experience of generating those questions really tunes up your ability to question.
Yeah.
Right. And to stay in curiosity and find what you can learn there. So if we on our teams and at work can activate that kind of curiosity, how could we do this better?
Yeah.
I mean, that's where innovation comes from. That's where invention comes from, right?
Yeah. I'm just reminded by a situation where I had a facilitation in the last years, and basically there was one person inside of that room which I had a conflict with earlier on. And I knew that if that person would walk inside of that room and I had to facilitate the session, I would have a hard time. And it took me in the morning before the session happened, actually, I think 1.5 hours, to get rid of my inner labels and everything I had judged and everything which had happened, to get back to zero, to normal, to have a clean slate, and then appear as a facilitator who was just curious about that person, about that person's contribution, and about the whole group process. And I really need to work inside that frame of being curious again. But when that happened, I was able to facilitate it really, really easy and on spot and on point. I think that's a great value as a coach and facilitator to unlock curiosity again and again and again, because the labels are from the past. I mean, they try to, it's a coping mechanism maybe, and we all label stuff and so on. It helps us navigate in the world, but it's not particularly helpful to have lost it along the way, right?
Yeah, yeah. I have a ritual before I work with a group, whether I'm leading a retrospective or some other kind of meeting, where I sort of spend some time sort of meditatively. I don't have a set meditation that I necessarily do, but thinking about and focusing on the fact that I am there to be in service to that group to get where they want and need to go.
Yeah.
And it's not about me, you know, or my what I care about in the situation. If I do care too much about the situation or have too much emotional connection to any of the people there, I'm not the right facilitator.
Yeah.
Because if I can't, I mean, what you talked about, the way you were able to prompt yourself into sort of letting go of some of that, that's so key, because we cannot walk into that room with that baggage.
Yeah.
I mean, that we're dragging too many chains with us. Yeah.
Then we just can't create what wants to be created, because we will steer it in our direction, right?
Yeah.
That's what you're saying. Yeah. Yes, and that's some kind of an art also, right?
Yes.
You can describe it, but it's also an aspect of learning that. And what I have found particularly helpful, and I also shared that with Norm already, was some thoughts of Arnold Mundell, who basically sees participants as co-facilitators. And I love that as a frame.
Absolutely.
Because I think for years I tried to, in a good way, manipulate and steer the room in a direction by my processes and make that and reach that result for no matter what price at some point. And when I realized and had that frame that it can be so much easier if you just trust the room and the process and the people and they will contribute and then everything's fine. You can still be surprised, but it's the thing which needed to happen, right?
Right, yeah. That's one of the things I like about open space, and that we, you know, that we use open space for the retrospective gathering, is there's a tagline that some people use in open space: be prepared to be surprised.
Yeah.
Right. And also take passion and follow your passion and take responsibility. And I think that's another important part of this, is the people who come here are here because they feel that responsibility to, you know, engage with the group however they show up and be able to do that. And they want to improve their ability to do that. And I mean, that's even after 21 years, that's why I show up. What new thing can I learn here that will help me become better at helping groups move to where they want it? What wants to be born here?
Yes. And there are those magic moments. Yeah. I can totally relate.
Yeah.
I've been out of the community for some years now with having a little kid again. And I basically, it was not possible because normally Jasmine and I join together every conference. And now we brought the kids with us. And yes, this is challenging on another level. But I think what Jasmine and I enjoy is really this being exposed to totally different mindsets about specific topics and the new way of learning which emerges out of that. If you are just confronted by a great idea or a question which relates to what you just said, and then you can up-level your thinking on a dimension which is tremendously cool, I think.
And it's so wonderful to have children.
They are great teachers.
they are great teachers. Well, and at an event like this, it's wonderful to have children because they are better learners than any of us. We get learning kind of taught out of us, and they can remind us what it means to be a learner. We also have some dogs here. It's a very similar kind of thing. It's like watching them interact with each other, and what can we learn from that? And how have they made friends? And because they don't all come from the same household, and you know, but it generates a spark. My son Wilma and I wrote a book called 5 Rules for Accelerated Learning, and the major rule is what we call alive, or keep it alive, and that has to do with connecting with people as humans and all the things that human beings respond to. And one of those is generations, right? Different generations, nature, our senses, all of our senses, color, music. I mean, all of those things are present in this event, which makes it a very rich and generative opportunity for everyone here, because the elements that cause learning to happen are built in to the way this event rolls out.
Yeah, and I think it's also reflected in the meaningfulness of a lot of sessions I've been witnessing, though I did not participate in them all. I see people being in deep inner processes and basically working with their own stuff and on a very sophisticated level here, and which is also a safe space because I think we all have the feeling we can hold that space together and it will work out, and have a lot of trust in those processes.
Right.
And what I also heard is that these generations are inspiring, and I think this relates to also the keynote which Norm has given. Like, I think there's a chance in renewing the agile ecosystem by the young ones entering that. Because, I mean, you've been longer here than I, and I've been here for 18 years, and I feel already as an agile dinosaur, and that's perspective. So I think the curiosity also belongs to those people who are joining that and who are now at the workplace starting out, and what are their questions and challenges, and how can we answer and relate to that by still offering our guidance and experience, which we have, but by allowing something new to emerge. Because I feel we live in a time where knowledge per se with an AI in my smartphone is not the primary thing, because I can learn about every existing thing on the earth if I ask ChatGPT, and it will give me a summary about the most important parts of that. But what do I do with all of that knowledge? Yeah. What is the action? What is the insight? And this is still a question. We have all the knowledge now at our hand, but what is the important part of it? And which knowledge do I need when? Even?
Well, and that's completely overwhelming. Yes. I mean, if you and you have it all, or at least all that we're aware of right now, I mean, you know, there is that as well. It is... I mean, this is huge, right? But it is only that knowledge that we are aware of and that has a place in the internet. And that's what these, the LLMs at least, and the diffusions, and that's what they can offer us. Yeah. What is known.
Yeah.
And they can do something that looks a little like interpretation, but there's still a room for human judgment. There's still a room for human responses and reactions, and how does this strike us? And so I'm really interested to discover how this unlimited amount of information and knowledge is going to work together with our need to keep learning as new things emerge in our environments and new technologies come along, and you know, just new experiences that we have that we've not had before. What is going to be the interplay between the learning part, the newness, the novel, the innovative, and what's already known, and which could be stifling? Which could be overwhelming.
Yeah.
And so we'll have to learn. We will have to learn how to manage this relationship, right?
Yes. And me being a computer scientist, the pace in which innovations happens right now and already is playing a part in my own company, and I can code some AI agents with some clicks and stuff. It's so freaking high right now. I've never felt that it has been so high. And this has some specific demands on our capability to generate insights and also to relax in between those deeper insights, right?
Right, right. There's a story I've told you, and your readers or listeners may have heard this before, but when I was, 30 years younger, so my grandmother was still alive. She lived in a city where they announced that they were going to shift from having a 7-digit phone number to a 10-digit phone number. Every phone number was going to include the area code, which it had never done before. It had always been local. And she looked at that and she said, "Well, now you're just all going to have to call me, because I can't remember that many numbers for all of you, and all, you know, you're going to have to." There's research that says people only remember 7 digits. You know, and we laughed. We thought that was so funny that she didn't think she was going to be able to call us. We were have to call her, right? We thought that was so funny. And in the last few years, I have had several moments when I've thought, no, I just don't want to learn that one new thing. And I have such compassion for her now. And I feel so bad for laughing at her, because she was born in 1906. She saw enormous technological changes and dealt with them. She was a teacher. She's a very brilliant woman. But she got to 10-digit phone numbers. She just called a halt. This is as far as I'm going with this, right? And but I feel that sometimes now. And when I first heard about AI, I have to say, I kind of, oh no, this is a whole new big area of stuff that I'm going to have to learn to grapple with. And do I really want to do this? And as somebody who works as a change agent, when I feel that kind of thing in myself, I know I need to pay attention because it's going to be what a lot of people are feeling. It's a change, and that's all it is. It's just another change. We've dealt with changes before. We'll deal with this one, but only if we know how to learn our way through it.
Yeah.
And that's the important part. We have to keep our ability to learn the new at work, at home, and socially, wherever, in order to make it serve us.
Yeah.
Be able to deal with it effectively, all those kinds of things.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. I can totally relate. And having kids which are still not in their professional lives, but still in school, sometimes if I think about their job choices, which if they ask me, what would you recommend to do in this upcoming society? And my oldest daughter, she's so good at painting, drawing mangas and stuff. She's so good at that. And then there's this itchy part in my head which says, I think AI will draw all of that stuff if I prompt it correctly. Is there even value in doing that? And then there's an artist inside of me which says, it's a self-expression. It's needed. We all need art and culture and creation, and it's something totally different.
Yeah.
And of course, I want to see her having a great job and being able to pay what she wants to buy in her life and live in a house or whatnot. And see, sometimes there's some kind of a tension upcoming in all the stuff which this AI frameworks can do then. Mm. And those classical artworks, like this, doing music instead of prompting the AI to create that music, which is based on the patterns we've been, and that's, there's some kind of a, I think I'm also on the edge of all of this new change, and it's working inside of me, and I haven't found my way, but I'm trying to, I desperately try to immerse myself with those ideas and play around with what's upcoming. But I'm totally with you. It is tough as a change per se, because it has so many implications.
Well, and it's things we've done before. I mean, just in the world of art, think about the huge change that happened, even just in France, around traditional painting and the academy and the shows they would have every year and so on. And then the impressionists come along, and all of a sudden, because they're saying, well, there are photographers that can do what you guys have been painting. We want to express something different. We want to express our impression of the moment, not specifically precisely the moment. And, you know, that was a huge, huge thing for folks to deal with at the time. And it took 40 years, 30 years for it to become really an accepted means of expression, where they weren't kind of on the edge, those bohemians, you know. And so it does take time. Humans don't make changes like flipping a switch. Mm-hmm. We have to, again, I'm going to use this phrase again, we have to learn our way through it. And that doesn't happen in a moment. I mean, once in a while we get a flash of inspiration, but not always, right? I mean, a lot of times it's incremental. We have to figure it out. And that's okay.
So, there's a revolution happening again. Better learn to be with discomfort then.
Right. Right,
and that's maybe also the question, right? What do you have, which you can connect to, which gives you strength in times of discomfort? Right. And I think that's also a great way to train that, is to be a facilitator, to be a retrospective facilitator, to be a facilitator per se, that you can be with discomfort, because in our groups we also have that, right?
Right, right.
And it's just another dimensional level then.
And I would encourage people to develop those facilitation skills. I have a friend who worked for a big, very big company. He's Austrian. I've just gotten to spend some time with him. And he worked for this very big company when I first knew him, but he was a meeting facilitator. He did all kinds of things to help people make decisions, manage conflict, do all those things, do retrospectives, do meeting project kickoffs, and you know, all that stuff, right? And then sometime later, he left the company, and then he decided after a little while more that he really wanted to do a different kind of work. And the thing that he had noticed that he loved was showing people around his city, showing people around Austria and stuff. So he went off and got trained as a tour guide and to have his own company as a tour guide. And when I was talking to him just this last week, he was talking about the ways in which his facility, surprising him, the ways in which his facilitation skills have contributed to his ability to be a really great tour guide.
Oh, yeah.
And he's sharing those skills with other tour guides in his community so that they can manage their groups of tourists and things better. And I just, that just tickled me. I just thought that's so wonderful. Yes. These skills, these ways of learning about how to be in groups, these ways of learning about learning can be passed on in all kinds of contexts. And I think are going to become critical for people in the years ahead.
Yeah. I can totally relate. We have taken a lot of those agile practices also to our private life. And there's one rule in our family that is to ensure that our kids are growing up well. We are very picky about the systems in which our children are contained while we're not around. And this is something I learned as a facilitator, basically to spot dysfunctions, spot functional systems, and have an awareness for what that does with me inside of such a group or setup, and thus being able to really reflect on what is most probably happening to my child if I'm not around. And then evaluate that and choose systems which work better than the system they are in. And this is one of the core pillars on how we raise our kids, that they are most of the time in a really functional system which has enough connection to spirit or heart or whatever qualities we want to have happening. And this is something which I totally took out of my role as a facilitator, which works really, really great in my private life.
And I know that you have 24 dozen other examples of something similar, and I have them too. And it is one of the benefits of doing the work that we do. Yeah. Is that we have these skills that we can apply in so many different ways.
It's so fulfilling. Yes,
yeah.
It is.
Yeah.
And maybe as a last thing to our audience, what would be some wishes you want to speak out loud for the future along the way for people to look for in those times, which you want to?
Well, I guess it would be that people are able to respond to new and startling developments in their lives with curiosity and with an intention to learn how to be effective in a world in which that also exists. I think that's, for me, that's just the most critical thing, is that we are able to do that. I mean, a book that I also published in just the last few years is called Lead Without Blame. And the reason that my co-author and I, Tricia Broderick, wrote that book was because what we know is that when there is a culture of blame and shame and judgment, there's no learning going on. Yeah. There is no learning. And we really want to free people to be able to respond with curiosity and ask questions and learn their way through things as the new things come. Because what is sure is that there are new things coming. I don't know what they are. I doubt you know what they are. Some people have an idea, but there's also this whole thing that the futurists talk about that we tend to over expect the near term and under expect what's coming later on, right? And so, you know, but what we can do is prepare ourselves to be responsive in those moments. Okay. And so that's what I wish for people.
Perfect finishing words, Diana. I loved the interview. It was great fun to hear your perspectives, your stories, and your current way of thinking about the world. So thank you very much for that exchange and the books you've written and the inspiration you've given to me and for being in the podcast.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.